I was invited a few weeks ago to join my wife at a company party Saturday night. And so I went, and that party normally takes shape around a dinner and a lot of chit-chat around the table and a dance, which we left before that happened. And during our table conversation, one of the ladies said, "Men do not wear white socks." Well, I'm here to show you today. White socks. Real men wear white socks. You too. There we go. All those wearing white... No, forget it. You know, something just irks in me when someone tells me what a real man should be or shouldn't be. Particularly when it comes to fashion statements. I'm no fashionista by any stretch of the imagination. But I don't like being conformed by the world either. But we have that tendency. Go ahead, I'm sorry, I forgot again. And 5 minutes before I got up here, my wife says, "Don't forget to hand out the clipboards." So my wife is going to hand the clipboards out to the kids that are here. Please put up your hands if you need a clipboard. Matthew back there put up two hands. I'm not sure what that means. Way in the back, Carol. The back left row. We do, as humans, we tend to develop patterns and we repeat those patterns. We're creatures of routine. We're creatures of habit. And I don't know about you, but I grew up in an evangelical church where we were taught to share our faith in a routine way. Okay, if you're going to share your faith, here's what you should say. Step one, step two, step three, step four. How many of you heard of the four spiritual laws? If you haven't, you haven't grown up in the evangelical world. How many of you have heard of the bridge to life? Some of you have. That one wasn't so popular. But we tend to be drawn towards formulas, methods. Because one person experienced success with a method, everybody else has to get on board and use that method. The message I'm going to share with you today is a demonstration of the fact that there was no set method or pattern that was used, at least on the surface, and that each person and each situation was approached uniquely and custom made for the occasion, so to speak. It seemed as if the Holy Spirit led individuals to speak in a certain way, to say certain things that were just right for the occasion. When you read through the Gospels and you follow the Lord Jesus Christ and His encounters with people, as He shared the Gospel, the good news, it wasn't the same with every individual. It was different all the time. And I think that we need to learn that approach. We need to learn to listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit. We need to learn to be sensitive to the circumstance that we're in and to the person that we're talking to. And nowhere do we learn that more than as we go through the book of Acts and we see that each situation is different. Imagine being asked to speak before a sizable gathering of intellectual philosophers and politician types who do nothing but debate each other about the latest ideas that have come along. Sounds like our town council, city council. You have been asked to speak to them about the meaning of life, where you think history is going, and the existence and the nature of God. And right now, the only passion that you have is to share with them an account of a humiliating, bloody execution of your Messiah, who was subsequently raised from the dead. You need to tell them that this happened outside a rebellious city in the Middle East, a city which is quickly becoming a real thorn in the side of the Roman Empire. And it's your task to argue that this story is the key to everything in life and to all that we know about God. What are you going to say? What are you going to do? How many of you have ever felt going into a situation, "I've got the gospel message, but these people are so sophisticated and so intelligent that they will just poo-poo me from the start. And I'm lost before I've begun. Ever felt that way? That was precisely the challenge that faced the Apostle Paul in Athens. His audience was made up of the leading intellectuals of Greece. To them, Paul had to proclaim that this whipped, bloody, shamed, abused Jew, who in the eyes of most of them was nothing but another failed, treasonous rebel from Nazareth, and that he was actually God with us. That's the challenge. That's going to help us to understand Paul's message if we understand who he's talking to. So, who were these philosophers and council members that made up his audience that day? Well, the context tells us that it was primarily the Epicureans and the Stoics who invited him to address them at the Areopagus. The Epicureans and the Stoics. Now, what is an Epicurean? What's a Stoic? The Epicurean was the empiricist of Paul's day. Now, I know some of you are thinking, oh, there he defines a hard word with another hard word. Empiricist is the one who would say, I don't believe it unless I can see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, touch it. Does that sound familiar to any of you? Any of you met people who've said that, unless I can touch it, unless I can put it under the microscope, I won't believe it. That's the Epicurean. But it doesn't stop there with the Epicurean. He judges the value of an action or thing in terms of the pleasure or pain that it brings him. A position that we call today hedonism or hedonism. Self-centered pleasure or pain. It was egoistic hedonism because the person sought his own pleasure rather than the pleasure of others. That's why your idea of an Epicurean is someone who delights in good-tasting food. It brings him pleasure. But it was far beyond just that. So an Epicurean lived for himself and what he could taste, touch, hear, smell, etc. He lived by his senses. What about the Stoics? Who was the Stoic? The word Stoic comes from the Greek word stoa, which just means pillars. And an area like you would have a fancy courthouse with a bunch of ivory pillars or marble pillars, that would be a stoa, and you've seen that Greek architecture everywhere. Well, the Stoics were the rationalists of the day, materialists and rationalists who held that all things basically come from one element, fire, and will eventually return to that one element in a vast cosmic conflagration. Well, they got that part right. They had a cyclical view of history in which one universe after another arises and is destroyed. Sounds like a karmic cycle today, doesn't it? Both the orderliness of things as we know them and this cyclical pattern of history were the consequence of the organizing and sustaining power of a pervasive force known as the Logos. Where have you heard the word Logos before? It's what John called Jesus. In the beginning was the word Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. The Stoics called the organizing principle of all that there is the Logos. And this Logos was often regarded as a divine force. But this Logos was a part of every person, and therefore to live according to reason is to live according to the natural order of things, and this is good. The good life is one in which reason, not emotion or passion, rules, and peace of mind and harmony with nature will consequently prevail. It sounds to me like Spock of Star Trek was a Stoic. Reason over passion. Reason over emotion. So this is what the type of person that Paul was facing in sharing his faith with them. And to add to the intimidation factor, this is the city where Socrates was sentenced to die. And he was executed with the poison hemlock for failing to acknowledge the gods that the city acknowledges and for introducing new deities. As if they didn't have enough gods, Socrates introduced a few more, and therefore he was executed or made to drink the poison hemlock. Now, of course, things have changed since then, but Paul must have had a sense of the history of this place. These are the people to whom Paul will now speak. How is he going to do this? What's he going to say? Well, he starts off in the same way that you might start off a conversation when you enter someone's home for the first time. You see a painting on the wall, and you say, "That's an interesting work of art. Did you paint that?" Or, "What a lovely photograph." You find some point of connection that is meaningful. And so that's exactly what Paul says and does. "I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" Paul jumps in with both feet, but he starts by making a point of connection with them. And he jumps in with both feet. Just across from this hill where he's speaking, known as the Areopagus, there is the Agora, and it's kind of a stadium where there was the altar of the 12 great gods, the Olympic gods of the Greeks. And we are in the middle of celebrating the Olympics right now as we speak. Tonight is the great hockey game, by the way. But here is the altar of the 12 great gods. The great gods are the gods of the Olympiad. Well, just how many gods do the Greeks worship? How many did they have? Because the Bible tells us that Paul was greatly distressed by all of the gods and the idols that he saw in the city of Athens. Well, besides the 12 Olympic gods and their family trees, because of course these Greek gods have babies and sisters and brothers and mothers and so forth, besides the 12 Olympic gods, there were 7 other categories of God. And just one of the categories of the gods that they had controlled the forces of nature. And in that category, you had sky gods, many of them. You had sea gods. You had underworld gods. You had agricultural earth gods. You had pastoral earth gods. You had city gods. You had titan gods. And you had deified mortals. And all of those categories had dozens of different deities. And I stopped trying to count how many gods the Greeks had. Not all of them were worshipped at the same time or in the same place, and cities were free to honor whichever god they wanted to, or localities, it didn't matter. They had so many gods that I had to quit studying them. I was running out of time. But imagine being brought up in a world where everyone believes that everything from the moment of conception until the moment of death is perceived through belief in a particular god who is responsible for that particular aspect of life. Like you go to the river and scoop out water to drink and you thank the river god, and you go to the tree and you thank the tree spirit, and it's animism. It's a belief that the whole world is controlled by separate deities. And these deities are all made to behave like humans because they fight, they have wars, they are jealous, they kill each other, come to life again, all kinds of things, just like in the human world, except for that coming to life again. They commit adultery, they cheat on each other. So that is the Greek pantheon, the panoply of gods that the Greeks believed in. As Rome extended its influence, and now you have a Greco-Roman world, and they would bring their gods in as well, and wherever they went, they would absorb the deities of the countries that they would invade, and they would let the people practice their own religions as long as it didn't contradict with theirs or infringe on theirs. Religious novelty was a source of fascination and mistrust. And particular practices were condemned as alien hysteria, magic, or superstition. And those that threatened traditional morality and unity were suppressed. So, here is Paul, and with that kind of a religious background characterizing the city, he has to address them and somehow bring them to the point of believing that Jesus Christ is the only way. So you can fully understand Paul's passion and why he says in verse 16, while he was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that city was full of idols. And so Paul appeals to their sense of religion. I can see that you are very religious. It's not clear in the text whether he is paying them a compliment here or criticizing them, because the word religious is actually superstitious. It can mean superstitious. But he's eager to fill in some blanks for them. It was not unusual to find in any Roman or Greek city an altar to an unknown god. This was not the only altar to an unknown god that was ever discovered. But it was rather simple why people would erect an altar to an unknown god. They were covering their bets. You know, they were just making sure that they didn't miss anyone. And so they would erect an altar to an unknown god, and they would bring this unknown god sacrifices, and they would worship this unknown god. So instead of Paul just jumping in right away and putting them down for their ignorance, he uses the unknown god as an ally in his preaching. And he doesn't have to tell them that they are ignorant. They themselves have admitted their ignorance. And now Paul wants to reveal to them the God who is unknown to them. Have you ever tried to tell unbelieving people that God is knowable? Or that you know God personally? It's not easy to convince people. I find it strange. I find it strange that unbelief in God actually engenders an unwillingness to admit that God is even knowable. I've come across this frequently just in the last few years, where when you say God reveals himself as knowable and he wants us to know him, people will respond by saying, "You are so arrogant. To think that the earth is somehow the center of God's attention, and to think that you, puny man, can know God, or that God would even be interested in you, is arrogant." And my response is, but it's not arrogant to point to scriptures and say, here is what God says. And if the great power that he is chooses to know us whom he has created, then that's his prerogative, and it's no arrogance on my part to take him up on his invitation to know him. If I tell you that I have an invitation to have an audience with the Queen, would you say that's arrogant? Well, it would be arrogant if I said to you, I'm calling the Queen tomorrow to tell her that I don't like the way she was dressed when I saw her on TV. And you would say, now that's pretty arrogant. But if I were to show you the letter with the seal that proved that this was genuine, it's not arrogant at all. It is humbling to know that the Queen would want to meet with me. So think of how humbling it is to know that the God of the universe, who created all that vast cosmos out there, wants me to know him and invites me to know him. Is God knowable? Yes, he is. And of course, one of the reasons I think that people refuse to admit that God is knowable is that they would have to then admit, I don't want to know him. It would make me accountable. I don't want to be accountable to God. I want to live my own life. But Paul tells them, this unknown God I'm going to proclaim to you. First of all, and I'm going to go through the list rather quickly, he is the God of everything that we see in the universe, and you are, by implication, his by virtue of creation, which means that you're accountable to him, doesn't it? Secondly, he is the Lord of heaven and earth. You are not only his by virtue of creation, you are his by virtue of his sovereignty. He does not live in temples built by hands. He is transcendent after all. He is transcendent. That means that he's not bound to one location. He is over everything, above everything. He is not served by human hands, which means he is self-sufficient. He cannot be manipulated by priests or by bringing oblations, sacrifices. He can't be pulled by strings. He made every nation from one man. Now, how important is this in the scheme of things? Up to this point, they could have said, you have your Jewish God and your theory of origins, and we have our Greek gods and our own theory of origins. In other words, Paul is saying this is a universal God, not just a local God. He made everyone that exists from one man, which means he made every human nation from one man. Common ancestry, we are one family. And then he says that God is the Lord of the seasons and the places. He's the Lord of nature, the Lord of history, the Lord of geography. He's pretty well the Lord of everything. And then we have a double purpose statement here that I find very interesting in the text. It says that they should inhabit the whole earth. And secondly, that men would seek him. I'm going to go to the text here. Acts 17. I'm reading verse 25. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men. Purpose statement. That they should inhabit the whole earth. Second purpose statement. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. Second purpose statement. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So God's purpose was that we should, number one, inhabit the whole earth. Number two, that men would seek him, reach out for him, and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. You know, Augustine was right when he said that in every man there is a God-shaped vacuum or hole that only God can fill. Many have no idea why they are restless in their souls, and they fill it with all kinds of stuff. Others know that they need something outside of themselves, and they go to different religions and different idols. And I'm amazed at the number of people that I'm coming across who are fully immersed in New Ageism or paganism or animism in North America, in sophisticated Toronto, where they believe in the same kind of stuff basically that the Greeks believed in the city of Athens, where the spirits governed nature, and where they were just as malicious and just as capricious as man. Paul declares to them this God who is the Lord of everything, and we are restless until we find our rest and our peace in him. Just as an illustration of how the lengths to which people go to, I had a phone call from a lady the other day who claimed to be an ordained minister. I asked her about the church where she was ordained, and she said it's the church of St. Margaret of Small Animals and Birds. I thought, what? It turned out that she was a bit, put it this way, she needed the kind of help that I couldn't give her. But it's an example of the lengths to which people will go to fill that emptiness inside of them. And Paul appeals to this internal longing for God that people have. And here's the thing. If we were created by God and we are made in his image and we were made for fellowship with him, there's got to be some kind of primeval longing in all of us to be connected with him, no matter how devastated we are by sin and corruption. Count on it in your witnessing. When you're sharing with others, everyone has this emptiness and this urge to seek him. But because of sin, we create idols and we worship them instead. And that is where the Greeks and the Romans were. And God's message to them through Paul is, I am the God that is all around you. I hold your hearts in my hand. I created the oxygen that you breathe. You are my children by virtue of the fact that I made you. And Paul even quotes one of their poets to make this point. This God is transcendent, but this God is also immanent. He is above all, and he's also in all and through all. And it's so strange how those who believe in God insist that God cannot be knowable because he is so other, or he must not be interested in this puny place. But the opposite is true, and people seem not to know it. The very air that they walk through and breathe is as if it was delivered to them by God's hand. The sun rises and sets by God's command. The beauty of nature is the result of God's direct creativity and glory and beauty. And people are oblivious to it. They are blind, spiritually blind. And it's the work of the God of this world who has blinded the minds of those who do not believe, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And now Paul begins to draw things to a conclusion, and so will I. Since we are God's offspring, it is wrong to think that we can make him out of gold or silver by the skill and the creativity of man. Think about it. If we are his offspring, if we are the result of his creativity, how dare we turn around and by our creativity make gods out of wood or stone or metal? Now, we are more sophisticated than that. We don't have those kinds of idols, but we have idols. And we worship them. We bow down to them, if not literally, figuratively. One of the idols that we need to be aware of and be constantly watching is the power of technology and the power of media and the power of celebrityism and, of course, the power of money, wealth, the power of sex. And because we have that emptiness inside, it is so easy to be drawn by these powers, and we gravitate towards them. Now, Paul says God has overlooked that in the past. In other words, he allowed you to be ignorant. He allowed you to continue in your idolatry. And Paul didn't say this. When God had every right to squash you like a bug, he allowed you. He allowed you. He kind of closed his eyes. He was merciful to you. But now he's commanding you to repent. A judgment is coming, and we have to answer to him. And Paul then brings out the ultimate proof that we are accountable to this God, and it's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, he's in Athens. It's far removed from the city of Jerusalem where Jesus was raised from the dead. These philosophers could not run down to the tomb to check it out. They didn't hear the first-hand reports of the eyewitnesses of the resurrection. And so it's no wonder that Paul got three different responses to the conclusion of his message. Number one, some sneered. Satan will see to it. He has his cheerleaders in every crowd. Number two, others procrastinated. They put it off. They said, we'll hear you some more on some other day. And thirdly, a few men became disciples of Paul and believed. Which group are you in? There are some who will mock. There are some who will say, that's for women and children. Real men don't believe that stuff. Well, I'm still a real man. Alvin Jones is still a real man. You heard his story. There's lots of men who believe this and to whom this is a passion. There are others who will say, you know what? There's still time. There's still time for me to make up my mind. Well, we were working with a young lady who had two children, and she knew that she had to make things right with God. She started seeing us. She would come see us maybe every 4 or 5 weeks for a short visit. And one day we got a phone call. She'd been hit by a semi-trailer with her kids. It's the hardest funeral I ever had to do. Buried her and her one child. The other one survived. But you don't know how much time you've got. If you believe this is true and you're putting it off, you're simply putting it off, but you know it's a decision you have to make.
make it today, because today is all you've got. There were others who believed. There were a few who believed. This gives me great comfort to know that even Paul only had a few results. It seems in North America that the church is getting fewer and fewer results in terms of the harvest. There are all kinds of reasons for it. Overseas, third world countries, the church is growing like crazy. Maybe it's their turn. Maybe God is directing his attention towards the neglected countries of the world, and it's about time. And maybe North America is going to be paying for a lot of its neglect. I don't know. But there is a verse that says, if judgment doesn't begin at the house of God, then what will the end be of those who don't believe? Which group are you in? Are you in the devil's cheerleaders group? Are you a procrastinator? You know that you have an obligation to do business with God, but you keep putting it off. Or are you one who receives the word gladly and grows?